session number 18836, Reel 1.
So, this is Hull Carriage, Reel 1. And if I could ask you first of all, Hal, and you've given me permission to call you Hal.
Please do, yes.
Could you tell me something about your early life before the war started? Whereabouts were you born and brought up?
Actually, I was born, I think, somewhere in East London. But my parents moved down to Barnes when I was about, a few months old. So I lived my very early life in Barnes.
Now, this is going back how many years?
That is going back to... I suppose it would be 1898 or 1899 or 1900, somewhere, because I was only a wee un. I couldn't think in that. My first recollection of being tipped out of a pram. So I was very, very young indeed.
So what did your father do?
My father's a civil servant.
And where did he work?
In Kensington.
And could you tell me something about your life as you were growing up, what it was like to be a young boy in those days, at the turn of the century?
Well, I lived the life of a normal boy of that age. We were not paragons of good behaviour, like most boys, but we weren't destructive or anything like that. We just enjoyed our school days.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had a brother who was 8 years older than myself. I had a sister who was 4 years older than myself, then myself, and then a younger sister who was 4 years old, who died when she was 4 years old of diphtheria. So there was really three of us in family during my lifetime, as it were. There was myself, my sister, and my elder brother.
How about your education, Hal? What sort of schooling did you have?
Oh, I had the elementary schooling. I think to a little tiny school in Barnes Common, I think I went to originally. It was a sort of kindergarten school, and from then I went to a secondary school, and it was a normal education of its era, that's all. In those days, there was no university. You graduated to a better class school, which I did, and that's where I finished, really, until I joined the army.
So you joined the army straight from school, did you?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Do you remember the actual outbreak of war in 1914?
Very well indeed. Very well. Yes, I think there was a tremendous wave of enthusiasm over the whole country, an enormous wave of enthusiasm. And it's hardly believable, but people then were queuing up for, well, you've seen queuing up for sales and that sort of thing on the pavement. And they were queuing up then to join the army for patriotic reasons. Queues half a mile long, all waiting to join the army. There was a wave of enormous patriotism. Because it's very difficult for me to try and get people like yourself, who are relatively young, to understand what the world was like in those days. 100 years ago, there was none of this electric light, there was none of these radios, there was none of this sort of nonsense. There was no street lighting. Very few trains, and there were steam trains, of course. There were no arterial roads like your M1s and your M6s. Your arterial roads in those days were rivers and canals. That's where all the heavy traffic came from. So not only England, but the whole world was like that. That was the modern world of its age. Everything was done by horses and vans. There were no supermarkets. Every little town had its own shops. There was the bootmaker, and there was the butcher, and there was the baker, and then there was the haberdashery, and what have you, all along the street. And my mother and the other women used to go out shopping, and all they did was give orders to the shops, and the shops delivered. And they delivered by van and horse. Now, I had a couple of youngsters here a week or two ago, and they asked me what it was like in those days. I said, well, there was no smell of petrol and that sort of thing. And one of the little girls there, she was only 11, she said, well, but there were other smells, weren't there? I said, yes, there were indeed, there were other smells. And I had to explain to them then how they looked after all the horses and that sort of nonsense, you see. And these two kiddies were sitting there open mouthed, they couldn't believe it. And the little girl 11, I said, not girls, because girls were different in those days. I said, little boys used to go about with the shovels and a brush amongst the horses' hooves and sweeping up. So I said, the atmosphere wasn't very nice, I can assure you. So, I got them interested in that. But to try and understand it, it's difficult for you to know what the world was like. The world, and not England, the world was like. It was the same in Germany, it was the same in France and Italy or any other place you went to.
Yes, it's very interesting, Hal, because one wonders how much you, as a young 16-year-old, knew about Germany, and where you would have got that information from in 1914.
No difficulty at all, because Germany in those days, if you can call them so, were our friends. Because after all, we were interlocked in marriage. I think it was with Edward the Seventh, was it? And Edward the Seventh and the Kaiser Bill. He used to come over here for grouse shooting in the autumn, and we and our crowd used to go over to Germany, I think, in the spring for pig shooting or something or other. But they're always going backwards and forwards. So as far as we were concerned, Germany were good friends. We had thousands of Germans in London, and I can only speak of London because I don't know what the rest of the country was like. There were Germans everywhere, but they were just ordinary people. They were in the shops. They had even German bands used to tramp along in the gutters playing the umpa-pa business, And they had to keep moving by law. And of course, they travelled about 1 mile a week. So near the whole of London, there was littered with Germans. And as I say, they were just accepted, that's all, just the same as we accept black people over here now. They were Germans, but they were just ordinary citizens, and that was that.
How quickly did that change once the war started, if indeed it did?
Well, there again, you've got to take your mind back to an England that you never knew, and you will never know how it operated. Because Great Britain in those days owned half the world. And if we didn't own it, we administered it through the Maharajas and what have you in India and Africa. Half the southern islands belonged to England, the Caribbean out that way. So literally we governed half the world. And when Germany started talking about coming to war with us, I suppose it was a reflex in a way. We are so used to being top dogs. The general atmosphere, what? Challenging England? Challenging Great Britain? What utter nonsense. Of course, we had no idea then that Germany had been building up for years. We had an enormous navy, which of course was our safeguard, being an island. So we were scared of nothing, really. We had an enormous navy, and we really governed the world with our navy. If anything went wrong, we sent a gunship out there and fired off a couple of cannons and put them in order again. So that was England in its day. And of course, Germany had been building up for a long time. They had a massive army, and they were well up to date with all their gear and equipment, in its day, of course. Puny stuff today, but in its day it was modern equipment. And when it came to war, the actual war in France, we were swamped. There's no two ways about that. We were on the retreat the whole time. We lost battle after battle, until we got down on the line of the Somme, which is within, which you know France pretty well, which is more or less in sight of the Channel, Channel ports. And then somebody dug their heels in there, and I don't know who it was at that time, it was running England. They said, this is as far as we can go. We can't go any further, otherwise they'll be on our own ports. So we dug in on the Somme, and that's where battles really started.
Yes, and I hope you're going to tell me about your experience there, Hal, as well. But keeping to the outbreak of war, do you remember where you were when you heard about the war and how you yourself responded to this?
Well, I was a schoolboy, and I had a schoolboy's mentality. As I say, the schoolboy's mentality was then, we were British, and nobody dare say anything about the British. Otherwise, they got their knees caned. Because we didn't understand, we were kids.
Did you have any idea that you might be involved in the war as a 16-year-old?
None whatsoever. To put you in the picture, as I told you, my elder brother was 8 years older than myself. Now, before the 1914-18 war, he had joined the then territorials, which you'd signed on for 2 years. So he'd completed his 2 years about 6 months before the 1914-18 war started. So he came out of it. Directly the war started, he joined up again immediately. And as he'd already spent 2 years in the army, he knew everything about the army, he knew all the drills and all the rest of it. And of course, he was invaluable to the army. So they gave him 3 stripes straight away. I think it was the Queen's Westminster's, I think he joined. And he never went out of the country. He was 8 years older than myself, and he never went overseas. They retained him the whole time for training purposes. Where his younger brother, myself, fool, I volunteered, and I mean that, I volunteered to go to France. I asked to go to France. Because friends of mine were going over there in the London Scottish. So I thought, well, I'm not going to break up the party. I'll go with them if I can. So I did. I volunteered and I went overseas with the London Scottish.
Why was it the London Scottish?
Why did I pick them? Because at that time we were living in East Sheen, which is just outside Richmond, as you probably know. Being pestered. It's dead. Yes, and we had the London Scottish then were billeted in lots of houses around about in East Sheen. And two of them were foisted onto my mother. So I got to know quite a lot about the London Scottish. I knew that they were the crack regiment of London. And I thought to myself, what a nice lot of chaps they were. I mean, I was only a schoolboy, remember? And I thought, what a nice lot of chaps they were. And I thought, if I've got to join the army later on, I want to be with the people like the London Scots. I don't want to go with the Poplar Stepney Gurkhas or somebody like that. When it came to a question of possibility of joining the army, I thought, well, if I'm going to join the army, I want to go in the London Scottish. And a friend of mine and I, out of sheer curiosity, said, well, we needn't sign on. Let's go and see what it's all about. Let's go up to London and find out what it's all about. Ask a few questions. And, of course, you know what it is then. We asked a few questions and our name was on the line and we were in the London Scottish. But prior to that, we were pestered. Because, remember, there was no such a thing as conscription. It was a volunteer army, pure and simple. And you had recruiting sergeants from all sorts of the East Surreys and the West Surreys and what have you, all after recruits for their own battalions. And you go out for a quiet walk, and about 5 minutes you find there's a sergeant walking beside you. He said, "You are a lucky looking lad, how about you joining the army?" It's no good of them talking to you, "Well, I'm only a schoolboy." They say, "Oh, we've heard that before." Any rate, you got absolutely pestered by these recruiting sergeants, all wanting you to join their particular regiment. And a friend of mine and I, coming through Richmond Park one time, we said, "Well, let's go have a little Scottish and find out what it's all about. We're not going to join, but we'll find out what it's all about." And, of course, that's how it happened. We went up there to find what it's all about, and we were in the London Scottish.
Did anyone mention your age? You know, the fact that you were 16. Did that come into it at all, Hal?
They just asked for your age. And you just blindly said 16. But blindly said 18. And they asked no more questions. It's all right, as long as you pass the doctor.
What was that like, the medical?
Oh, stiff. Very stiff indeed. Because it was London Scottish. So if you marked A1, then you were in. So my other friend Tom and I were both in the London Scottish. And he was the same age as myself. I think he was about 4 or 5 months older than myself. That's all.
Were you given the King's shilling?
Yes, we were, yes. And it was collected at the gate on the way out.
Is that so?
Yes. Oh, yes, they all stopped you there for the regimental funds. Well, it's one of those things. Nobody wanted the shilling. It was just a nominal sum. You could have done it, yes.
What did your parents think when you went home and told them you joined the army?
They were horrified. They were absolutely horrified. But what could they do about it? I mean, you've been 16, and you know perfectly well, when you're 16, you think you know everything, when you know nothing. So they just accepted it. They said, "Oh, silly young fool," or something like that, and that was that. I know my father was particularly upset because he'd got one son already in the army, and then to see his younger son also going on draft overseas, it wasn't very nice.
Yes, because you were saying you particularly asked to go to France. Is that right?
Yes, I did. Because, like everything else, you get one or two people around you you sort of get on with very well. And I had two or three friends at that time who were out on draft. And I think I was held back. I think they had a pretty good notion that I wasn't anything like 18. Because I was held back from draft. Where these other friends of mine were put on draft to go overseas. And they said, "Oh, come on, Hal, come out with us." So I went and saw the adjutant. And I asked him if I could be put on draft, as I had friends of mine going out there. So he looked at my records, he said, "You're a fully trained soldier, and if you want to go, all right, go."
So how old were you when you went, Hal? Were you still 16?
I was about 16, yes. I was about 16 then, 16 and a bit, I suppose. As I don't ask me for actual dates, I can never remember dates.
So when you went in the army, what sort of training were you given before you went overseas? Were you sent anywhere for training?
No, I spent, I think, 2 or 3 weeks only in billets, and it wasn't in my own home billet, it was somebody else's house. And then we moved into Richmond Park under canvas. And I did most of my training in Richmond Park. And from Richmond Park, the whole battalion was moved down to Hazley Down, which is just outside Winchester. So I spent the latter part of my training in Winchester, and I think it was from Winchester that I went overseas.
Do you remember much about your training? What you know, what they put you through before you went overseas?
Tough as hell. It really was tough. But there we are. We were fit youngsters. And we could take it. It's a good job we could. Otherwise, we'd have never stood France. We'd have crumpled immediately.
Because you, of course, were in the infantry, weren't you?
Pardon?
You would have been in the infantry.
Oh, yes, we were infantry. The PBI.
What does that mean?
The poor bloody infantry.
So what did the training consist of, Hal?
Well, it was regimental drill to start off with, to get you fit, to get you super fit. You had to learn all regimental drill, like square bashing and all that sort of thing. And you got that day after day, in all weather, stripped down across the waist. It doesn't matter whether it's summer or winter. So, and particularly out here at Aisley Down, it was perishing cold in the winter. But you get used to it, you get hardened to it. It's amazing how you do.
How about weaponry training?
Oh, well, you had usual, all rifle drill and that sort of thing, and then you got down on the ranges, firing drill. So that you knew which end of the rifle to use. Yes, so it's very, very strict training indeed.
How about your kit? Because you were in the London Scottish. Did that mean you wore a kilt?
All the time. I wore a kilt for 4.5 years and I dreaded the day when I got to put trews on again. I love the kilt and I'd wear one today if I could.
So what was it about the kilt that was so nice?
It's a dress that's fascinating. Once you get used to it, it's a fascinating dress. Because it's only a throwback from the original Scots of Ireland, of course, were kings in their own presence. So you've got the Gordons and you've got the Seaforths and you've got the Camerons and what have you. And they all had their own little castles on top of their own little hills and they're all kings of their own castles. And most of those had a territorial unit affiliated with them. And that's where I went to the Gordons, because the Gordons was our parent regiment in the regular army.
What do you wear under a kilt? Do you mind me asking?
Now then, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to give you a Scotsman's answer?
You can give me any answer you like.
I'm a man of few words. Give us your hand. No, the plain answer is if you wore anything under a kilt, you'd have been issued with it. You didn't get that issued, so you didn't wear anything. And many, many, many ask that, of course. I mean, a pseudo-Scotsman, of course. After all, we were Londoners. But I knew because I had an association with the Scots at home. But many of the new joiners, they hadn't a clue. They were horrified.
Yes, I was wondering about the cold conditions that you've described, you know, and how difficult that might have made things if you were wearing a kilt. Cold and wet and barbed wire and things like that. Did it make you more vulnerable to battle conditions?
No, it's one of those things you get used to. Because after all, in wearing a kilt, you've got all the protection where it's mostly needed, round the stomach. So all the pleats go round the stomach, as you know. I think from memory, is it 7 or 9 yards to every kilt? And when that's all pleated up, that's a nice big bunch round your waist. And that's the place to keep warm. Your legs and your arms and that sort of thing, get used to the cold. You don't notice it. No, it's a gorgeous dress. And I wear it today. I wouldn't look so good in it, though, mind you. It's something you don't realise. It's a manner of walking as well. You get used to the swing of the kilt. You do, you get absolutely used to the swing of the kilt. And you take two regiments in the days gone by, I'm talking about going back 1914. You get two regiments on the march. One of them's perhaps a light infantry and a Scottish. And the light infantry is left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. And the old Scottish left, right. But we'd finish first. The others would crumple by the wayside. And you must realise, and people don't realise that, there was no transport in those days. People are shocked when you say there were no lorries to take your gear with you. You were your own transport. You had a normal kit, weighed about 60 pounds on your back, plus a rifle and bayonet, which was another 10 or 11 pounds, and that was your normal kit. Now, on top of that, you very often had to other auxiliaries. You had extra bandoliers of ammunition. They are damn heavy. You had to carry those about with you. If you're a machine gunner or anything like that, you've got to carry panniers of bullets around with you. So in the end, you're a walking home, and that was your home. You had nothing else. You took your home with you. You had your mess tin there, and you bought a bottle, and your entrenching tool, and all those things. Everything that you needed was stacked all around you. And you got so tough that you'd hump that for 20 miles. And we were only kids, mind you. A few of us were only kids. The others were fellows of 20 and 20 odd. They were bit more robust than we were, but we stuck it out.
How about bagpipes? Did you have bagpipes?
Yes, we did indeed. Very fine, yes. Yes, we had a fine band of pipers. Grand chaps. Well, they were the things that kept you going on the march. When the pipes started up, it was... You could see it after you've been out for a day's march on training. This has nothing to do with the war itself. This is purely on training. We've probably been out all day marching. We've probably done 20 miles with this pack on your back. And we finish up in Richmond Park, dead beat, but just about crippled. And as we got into the gates of Richmond Park, the band was started up. You see everybody's shoulders up immediately. And we'd finish like that, as if we were just going out. It was a pride of the regiment. I have, many other people have said the same thing, and I suppose that is one of the attractions, I suppose, of the kilt. It's different from anywhere else. You see, whatever other regiment you joined, you either wore breeches or you wore trousers like this, or... We were the only crowd that wore a kilt. And it was different. It was attractive, no doubt about that. It was attractive. And the Scots, and I say this without a blush, because I was a Londoner, pure and simple. The Scots had a reputation that was not enviable, I assure you. Because if there was ever any trouble going anywhere, call in the Scots, they'll sort it out. And that is why, if you look at the record of Scottish regiments, you'll find that their casualties record is higher than most anybody else's. Because once they get the bit between their teeth, you can't stop them. I could show you a cutting. It's now 80-odd years old. When I was last wounded, the first thing I wanted to do was let my people know that I was all right, but you couldn't do anything about it, except send them a normal postcard, so I'm wounded, but don't worry, it's nothing. Nothing to worry about. And my father evidently read the letter, and he was no fool. And he'd read in the paper about an action by the Gordon Highlanders and others where we had taken a large chunk of territory. And he sent it out to me. And I've still got it. It's all in tatters now, but I've still got it, and that's 80-odd years old. And that came out of, I think it was at that time, two or three papers. It was either the Express or the Mail or one of the standard papers of its day, or the Telegraph or one of them. So that's rather a relic in itself.
So could I now ask you about going overseas? You know, it's so interesting what you've been saying about the kilts and the bagpipes.
Mm.
Because, you know, you have described this so interestingly. But going overseas now, Hal, this would have been the end of 1914, beginning of 1915, presumably.
Around about 15, 16 when I was actually out there, yes.
So what was that like, first of all, the journey going overseas?
The journey? Well, we went in the usual steam train that was available at that time. I mean, we started out from somewhere down Winchester or Southampton or somewhere like that. No, we started from Folkestone. Folkestone to Boulogne. And from Boulogne we went on to Etaples, and then